You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents...
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as The Daily Meditation Podcast, The Accidental Creative, and I Know What Scares You. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk. Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Connecticut was the fifth state to ratify the United States Constitution. It's the southernmost state in the block of states known as New England. It has about 5,500 square miles of territory and is home to about 3.5 million people, roughly half the population of the city of Atlanta. So it's not a huge place, but it turns out that it's home to a robust ecosystems of monsters from cryptozoology, myth, and folklore. To find out more about this overstuffed creature container, we're joined by Patrick Scalisi and Valerie Ruby Oman, creators of the new book, Connecticut Cryptids, A Field Guide to the Weird and Wonderful Creatures of the Nutmeg State. This is a fun and informative collection of legends, lore, and more. Links will be in the show notes, but let's just get right to the
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, Patrick Scalisi and Valerie Ruby Oman.
Yes. Hello.
Welcome. Hello. Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. So this is cool. First of all, behind the scenes, the listeners won't know this until we tell them right now. It's like, we had a hard time getting this to work. We had a bunch of booking conflicts and health issues and whatnot. And even
I
as we speak,
it was ghosts and demons and spirits that were keeping us apart.
The cryptids were keeping us apart.
Yeah, something supernatural, definitely. But now we're all here. We're so grateful to be able to chat with you guys.
Absolutely.
And you have put together a wonderful book that we want to recommend to our listeners. And it's called Connecticut Cryptids, A Field Guide to the Weird and Wonderful Creatures of the Nutmeg State. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was it hard to get out the door?
We worked on it for quite a while. It was about 3 years from start to finish, from the point that I started doing the research on it. Val came aboard, us getting the first draft done, revisions done, all the illustrations, having a graphic designer do the layout, cover design. So yeah, about 3 years from start to finish.
Well, the outcome looks really nice. It's a very good looking
book. Oh, thank you. So.
It does.
Thank you.
And I just want to ask about the Nutmeg State, because I've heard of nicknames like the Sunshine State and the Peach State, but the Nutmeg State, what's the story behind that?
Ooh, now you're going to be putting me on the spot. Do you remember the Nutmeg State story?
I think it has something to do with people selling fake nutmeg, right? Like, we don't actually grow nutmeg in Connecticut. Like, we're not known for nutmeg, but I
didn't expect this.
Yeah, I think, like, people were selling fake nutmeg and, like,
so,
you know.
It's more like nutmeg.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah, we haven't been asked that before. Yeah. I should have brushed, since we used it as the subtitle of the book, I should have brushed up on the history.
Well,
Connecticut has a few nicknames, because we're also the Constitution State, because we had one of the first constitutions, which was hidden in the Charter Oak during colonial times, and there's a whole story that goes along with that too.
No, well, I just assumed that Connecticut was famous for its nutmeg production. So
yeah, it's actually
interesting.
I'm looking at the state library for Connecticut, and there's a thing that says the sobriquet the Nutmeg State is applied to Connecticut because its early inhabitants had the reputation of being so ingenious and shrewd that they were able to make and sell wooden nutmegs.
Oh,
yeah, doesn't sound good. About right.
That sounds wild. That's so funny. You know, here I'm in the Peach State, where I just, for the record, we apparently are not the leading state for producing peaches. I think that goes to South Carolina. So these state names, suddenly I'm a little skeptical of all this.
My goodness.
Yep, there's another episode.
Well, I don't know. I assume, Karen, you felt the same way, that I was just kind of overwhelmed when looking at your book that a state as small as Connecticut could have such a large...
Mm-hmm. So rich cryptids.
Field of monsters. Yeah, it's just... Oh, yeah. You've got a lot of entries in here.
It was kind of surprising to us as well. When I first started doing the research, I didn't know what form the project was going to take. I knew some of the bigger stories that Connecticut is home to, like the Black Dog of the Hanging Hills and the Winstead Wild Men. And I knew there were possibly some others out there. So I was like, well, let me do the research and see where it leads. You know, maybe it'll be a blog. Maybe it will be enough to fill a book. And as I started contacting historical societies and collecting these stories, it really became clear quite quickly that there was enough to fill a book. I'm as surprised as you.
Yeah, I counted about 40 cryptids or more. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, it's a good cross section of the state as well, because we have it kind of arranged geographically by region, and we have representation in every part of the state.
For listeners, we have listeners, we're a pretty skeptical podcast. I found your book to be very lighthearted and whimsical and fun. But just to set listeners' expectations, if they go to buy the book, do you see yourselves as more skeptical or believers, or where do you fall in this? And what's a certificate in cryptid field observation or certificate in cryptid illustrative works? Are those real? What?
That is a work of fiction and whimsy.
Ah.
we kind of wanted to have the characters of Pat and Val be like separate from ourselves, so we kind of added a little bit of fantasy to it, which I think is appropriate considering both Pat and I consider ourselves skeptics. I mean, I know I personally, I love cryptids. I have been interested in them, like, even before I started this project. But I go into these stories with like a very healthy dose of skepticism, although I would love to see something that I can't explain. And I think there are some stories in the book that definitely do feel like, wow, maybe this is something that we haven't discovered yet. And maybe this is something cryptid, you know?
Oh, well, we like that approach. That definitely fits in with the show. But I want to hear about your cryptid research-related injuries, because I understand that one resulted in an amputation while the other was buttocks-related but didn't have anything to do with aliens. Tell us about that.
Nothing to do with aliens and all to do with figments of our imagination and the kind of fictional versions of us in the book. Like Val said, as we were editing the book, there was a feedback that we got and was consistent among several of the reviewers about how they wanted to bring more of quote unquote us into it. And so that was kind of our solution, was to sort of fictionalize ourselves, or the versions of ourselves in the book. And you kind of get almost a through narrative with the note cards that are presented at the end of each chapter as we sort of go through and do our research.
I like that, especially the one that had the coffee cup rings on it. Those are great.
Yeah.
You know, those were a relatively late addition to the book, and I feel like I had so much fun doing them, because I was like, all right, well, I got to do one for every chapter, and I don't want them all to be the same and just a note card with writing on it. So let me see what kind of fun stuff I can do with them. And yeah, it became a very fun creative exercise.
Speaking of illustrations, I saw that there were some very cool illustrations in here. Now, are those real? Are those based on actual things you saw in real life? In all seriousness, tell us about the illustrations, because they're fun, they're whimsical, they are sometimes a little creepy. They're neat. What went into the illustration decisions?
Thank you. I appreciate that, first of all. And I had a lot of fun with the creepy ones. Those ones were my favorites to do, like the Mystic Pigman and the Jewett City Vampires. I had a lot of fun with those ones in particular. Just because I'm into the kind of macabre aesthetic, but I had a lot of fun with the entries that were more like, I think you said, like whimsical, and really kind of fantastical, because the ones that were kind of based more in reality, weren't as thrilling to me, I guess. There's a couple of them, like there's like the black fox, there's a black dog, there's the white wolf, and they're all just kind of dogs or wolves or whatever. And so it was kind of challenging making normal creatures look extraordinary. So I definitely I struggled with those a lot more than I did the super fantastical beasts, which is kind of funny because I was kind of not using a reference for a lot of those ones, but I found it more challenging to work with the ones that I actually was using a reference for.
Neat.
And I'm wondering what kind of criteria did these creatures have to meet to be considered a cryptid? So you've got 40-something cryptids, and some of them are pretty out there. So Perry Boney comes to mind, fairy man that could speak to animals?
Yeah, when we were setting the kind of parameters of the book, we knew that we mostly wanted to focus on stories related to creatures in some way or another. Connecticut has a really rich tradition of ghost stories, and there are dozens and dozens of books about Connecticut ghosts and hauntings, some more famous than others. So we knew for the most part that we wanted to focus on creatures and less so on ghosts, hauntings, or things that were definitely human related. Mm-hmm. But as we kind of learned, as we learned more about cryptozoology and everything that entailed, those lines sometimes get very blurred. So some people consider UFOs a kind of cryptid. Some people don't. Some people consider bay creatures cryptids and some don't. So it's definitely a bit of a fuzzy category, but we knew that we mostly wanted to focus on things that were not human or no longer human. So that's why things like Perry Boney fit in, because there's the suggestion that he was some kind of fairy creature, that he wasn't human, that he kind of stepped into our realm for a little while and ran his little store.
The interesting character indeed.
Yeah. Raccoon illustration is really good too, with the with him with the raccoon. That's neat.
I love everything about that story. That's my favorite story from the book, is the Perry Boney chapter. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with the illustration too. So yeah, that's a very, I highly recommend that chapter.
Yeah, he's
yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting because it sort of like merges with fairy lore, but also it reminds me sort of like a East Coast Grizzly Adams who could talk to the animals. You know, it's
yeah,
kind of neat.
Bit of everything.
A surprising number of mermaids in Connecticut. To me, mermaids seem so implausible, but yet they still, people still, as recently as just a few years ago, were saying that they were real animals. And of course, there was that Mermaids, the Body Found Animal Planet sort of nonsense documentary. But can you tell us a little bit about mermaids in Connecticut, especially the Stratford Point Lighthouse? There was another one too, the Lordship Mermaids. Yeah, tell us about mermaids in Connecticut. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now these are no nonsense Yankee mermaids. These aren't like those lazy Southern mermaids sitting around on their porches. What?
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the mermaid at the Stratford Point Lighthouse was seen by the lighthouse keeper, and he claimed to his dying day that that mermaids lived off of Stratford Point, that he saw them often when he was on his shift at the lighthouse. During his lifetime, he was backed up by both his assistant lighthouse keeper and his wife, who corroborated his story and said, "Oh yes, there are merfolk living off the coast of Connecticut." But the lighthouse keeper, his name was Theodore Judson, by the way, he also claimed to have nearly caught a mermaid once, and it regrettably slipped out of his grasp. But as a consolation prize, she happened to drop her hairbrush during her escape. And he had a whole story for how the mermaids got their fashion accessories. He said that they would take things from the cabins of sunken boats, and that's where they got their hairbrushes and stuff. And he supposedly had the hairbrush on display at the lighthouse for anyone who doubted his story. But what I thought was so wonderful about this particular story was that Theodore Judson was fairly well known in his time in Connecticut, enough so, and he was the lighthouse keeper for long enough that he had a kind of storied career in Stratford, and he was so well known that he warranted a obituary in the New York Times when he died. And the obituary mentioned the mermaid story, something along the lines of friends never could get him to recant the mermaid tale or something like that. So,
wow.
That's neat.
Yeah, he was quite the character.
Now, does the hairbrush survive?
I wish I knew. Yeah. The hairbrush kind of disappears after Theodore retires. Nothing else is said about it or heard about it. I wish we knew where it was today.
having seen The Little Mermaid about 3,000 times, with my kids, I can't help but imagine that it's really a fork, you know.
See, and I always kind of imagine like this like metal hairbrush, but it's all encrusted in barnacles and like maybe a little rusty.
Nice.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. So Connecticut just seems to be so chock full of cryptids. And you even have big cat sightings. So they're fairly common around the globe, and we've spoken about them a lot over the years ourselves here on the show. But I was intrigued by the killer cat case. So could you tell us a bit about that and what makes it so compelling?
Yeah, absolutely. The killer cat follows the kind of same sort of story arc that a lot of these tales do, and something was happening in this part of Connecticut where folks were losing their livestock, maybe had pets go missing a bit, and people were saying, oh well, it's a mountain lion, oh well, maybe it's a big cat that escaped from a zoo. Other people were saying it's a dog. Other people were saying, you know, it's a lynx or a bobcat, and then they would be refuted by others who said, no, it's way too big for one of those things. And it kind of captured the whole imagination of this town for several months in, you know, this whole period between its biggest activity was in 1959, but it was first seen a few years earlier. And so, yeah, people were desperate to find out what it was, and kids would put up wanted posters on the light poles. I think I found articles about that in the Hartford Courant where they would put wanted the killer cat and things like that. But it's interesting because it ties into this whole thing about big cats being in Connecticut, and our Department of Energy and Environmental Protection says that there's no breeding population here, but dozens of people spot them every year. And I had to laugh because I was listening to one of your previous episodes, and I'm sorry, I don't recall which one, but you were talking about this same phenomenon in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And I was like, yep, we have the same thing in Connecticut. People see mountain lions all the time.
Yeah.
People see them, people report them, and the Department of Natural Resources says, nope.
Yep.
Not a thing.
Copycats.
So, yep. I mean, I think people are looking for, they need some DNA, they need some good trail cams, you know, something, but
yeah,
you're absolutely right. It reminded me immediately of Pennsylvania. So
absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are people as adamantly and vociferously trying to prove the case? Because in Pennsylvania, it's downright hostile how people who think they're really there sort of conflict with the state officials.
I mean, how would you characterize it, Val? I feel like it's almost more of like a kind of conspiracy theory feeling here.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't say it's like aggressive. I'd say there's some people who are quite passionate about it, but you know, not to the point of like mass hysteria or anything. I think like kind of like a conspiracy type thing makes sense to me.
Like they're out there and the government doesn't want it. What's funny is I think it has its roots in plausibility.
Yeah.
In that people believe that they're out there, but the government doesn't want to recognize them or recognize that there are a breeding population in Connecticut, because then it would entail certain protections, which would require, you know, a whole bunch of work and all of that.
Did I just hear a cat?
Yeah, that's one of our cats.
Yeah, yeah, but it's very on point. Yeah. So well done.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you for your input. You are not a large cat. Yeah. You are a small house cat. I feel like it has its roots in plausibility, because people say they're out there, but if the government acknowledges it, then they would have to be protected and everything that entails. So I feel like, yeah, it's more of a conspiracy theory type of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Now, some of this research involved field work, right? So what kind of evidence were you able to pull together for any of these claims? I'm especially thinking here about the Winstead Wild Man. But were you able to do any work there and find real evidence yourself?
We went to a number of the locations. What were some of the places that?
Yeah, I went to locations. I mean, I just enjoy hiking and being outdoors. I know Pat does too, but Downs Road Monster, that one comes to mind. I actually went down Downs Road to get an idea of like the setting for that, and that illustration actually, the trees and shrubs and stuff, that is, I did an illustration of the woods in that road. So
yeah,
that's the kind of research I did. Like obviously my portion of the book is very visual. So researching just the kind of natural landscape was important for me. Again, unfortunately I didn't find anything, you know, that felt very cryptid to me, but I saw a lot of very pretty scenery. So that's always a good thing.
If you don't mind a quick follow up, I've been to Connecticut, and the area that I went to was just one town after another bleeding, you know, seamlessly into the next, with a bunch of wonderful people and wonderful pizza places. But is there some rural areas still remaining in Connecticut? Like where do these monsters hide in the sort of the wild? What are the wilds of Connecticut like?
Well, I mean, it's definitely not like the wilds of like Pennsylvania or like, you know, anywhere in the South or any. It is highly populated, but we do have like the quiet corner of Connecticut. Yep. There's a lot of farmland and things like that. Even where Pat and I live in Naugatuck, we have the Naugatuck State Forest, which is massive, and
it spans like three towns.
Yeah, it spans three towns, and it's gorgeous. There's a lot of really beautiful hidden gems in Connecticut. Pat and I we're nutmeg for life, you know. we will defend the state until we die. Whether or not it's warranted, I don't know, but there are a lot of natural places in Connecticut if you're like willing to look, and certainly places where it would be plausible for a cryptid to live.
To kind of go back to the research thing, one of the places I went to was the cemetery in Jewett City, where the Jewett City Vampires story took place. And what I think is so interesting about that whole story is that I guess prior, my understanding of how this all played out was that prior to the 1990s, there was this whole idea that this great New England vampire panic had happened, where people were disinterring their loved ones after they had died because tuberculosis was spreading and they thought it was a vampiric disease. And the only way to protect yourself was to do certain purifying rites on your dead relatives. But there was no evidence in this regard that this had happened. It was all kind of hearsay and newspaper reports and that kind of thing. When the Jewett City Vampires story first began in the 1990s, when the graves were first discovered, and the archaeological part of that research began, the state archaeologist at the time got in touch with this expert from Rhode Island who was well known in this subject area, and come to find out that the Jewett City Vampires story and the graves that they uncovered are to this day the only archaeological evidence that they've found that this actually did happen, which is why it was very exciting for a lot of those researchers to finally have that proof to put with all of these kind of rumors that this had been going on in the 1800s. And as a kind of coda to that, DNA research has gotten so good over the past 30 years since these bodies were discovered that every few years they make new discoveries about them. So it just happened recently that even though this was first uncovered in the 1990s, DNA research has gotten so good that they've recently been able to do like a facial reconstruction of what one of these people might have looked like. They were able to use genealogy data banks to find a likely identity for this person. So I thought that was really cool in terms of a story in which kind of evidence was found, although maybe not in the way that people thought.
Now, this is the case where children playing in a construction site found the bodies, right?
Correct. Yeah. Children were playing near a construction site, and part of the hillside, I think, gave way under loose soil, and it uncovered what was essentially just, a local gravesite, a local unmarked gravesite.
But randomly, it was the vampiric burial that they had found.
that was one of the ones that that was absolutely one of the ones that they found. I think there were at least three or four, and they belonged to multiple families, but the one in question was marked JB on the casket.
That's
with brass.
That's short for just buried.
Yes.
I think Ken Fader is a friend of the show, and he's from Connecticut, and I believe one of his colleagues was the archaeologist who quite literally dug in on this case. So yeah, I'll have to. We probably should do a whole episode on that. That's quite a good story.
The archaeologist was Nicholas Bellantoni. And he had quite the storied career when he was the state archaeologist.
Wow. Well, we are getting towards the end of the show, but you've told us about vampires, and Connecticut has lake monsters and hybrid creatures like the goat man and the pig man. Are there any other cryptids that our listeners should know about from Connecticut?
Well, I think one of my favorite stories, and one of the ones that's lesser known, is the Old Saybrook Blockheads. And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, how the lines between these things are kind of get blurred. And this is actually a UFO story, but it had to do with this woman whose name was Mary Starr, and she was incredibly well-educated, well-traveled. She spoke multiple languages, did some incredible work during World War II. And it just so happened that one night later in her life, she had this encounter with these creatures in her backyard. And she didn't tell anybody about it for a year afterwards, where she finally kind of reported it to a UFO group. And it was just kind of this one part, one fascinating part of what was also a very, very fascinating life. So I love that story, and I think that's really fascinating. I think she's really fascinating, and I'd love folks to read that chapter.
Well, we touched on my personal favorite, which is Perry Boney. I'm trying to think of, I mean, I know you also kind of mentioned, oh, well, the Mystic Pigman is a good one. Yeah. there's so many. It's just, it's hard to pick. But the Mystic Pigman is, I think, one of the more iconic ones that kind of gets overlooked sometime. And it takes place in Mystic, which is a very iconic Connecticut, you know, seaside town.
I've been there.
Yep. Mystic Pizza. Last time we were just in Mystic, and I still to this day, I shouldn't be saying this on air, but I've not tried Mystic Pizza. I haven't. Oh. I know it's a travesty, but the Mystic Pigman is is that from the 60s?
70s.
The 70s. Yeah. Yeah, there was this reported sighting of a man by the drawbridge who had the head of a pig, and he was allegedly seen drowning a woman. And just the visuals of that story, for me, you can make a whole horror movie on that, and it would be fantastic. Set it in Mystic, Connecticut. It could be a blockbuster hit. So I really like that story.
Yeah, I've had a weird fear of pig-headed people for a long time. Like a completely irrational and weird thing, but it's like I remember some friends of mine, you know, growing up in high school, they were always joking about it. Because what a strange thing to be afraid of, you know, because it's not like a thing you run into in real life. And then now recently my kids have been watching this cartoon Demon Slayer, and then one of the heroes of the show wears a boar's head mask, and it's really turned me around. But I'm still sort of fascinated by pig-headed people and pig people. It was like House on the Borderlands from years ago. Anyway, just lots of reasons. Pigs are scary sometimes.
They can.
Yeah, we've done some shows on that.
We have. And then, of course, I still eat the sausage. I'm not afraid. Yeah. So maybe that's why I'm afraid of them. Maybe because I'm afraid they're going to make me sort of pay the toll. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Better beware.
Basic marketing question. Where can people find your book and your other work? And what's next? What are you working on?
Well, people can find the book anywhere where books are sold, as the saying goes. It is available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. If folks have a local independent bookstore that they like to support, they can ask the bookstore to order it. It should be available through a major distributor, and they should be able to get it special ordered. Same thing with, my previous work. I also have a novel out. It's a young adult, middle grade sci-fi novel that is also available wherever books are sold.
And we can link to all those in the show notes for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. And as for what's next, well, right now I think we're kind of just spreading the word about Connecticut cryptids. We're doing lots of events. We're also collecting stories along the way. I don't know what is going to become of those. There were a few that we've learned about since the book has been released that,
maybe
there will be a revised edition in the future in which we add additional chapters or something like that. But I think right now we're kind of just
riding the wave.
Yep.
Yeah. And enjoying talking to folks about it, really.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
Nice. Well, we've certainly enjoyed talking with you, but the time has come to ask you our signature question. You know what's coming. So Pat and Val, what are your favorite monsters?
You go first.
My favorite monsters. I think I would probably have to go with, I think, vampires, honestly. For me, I think it's going to be vampires. I think there's a lot you can do with the genre. It can be really really scary or horrifying, but it can also be kind of sexy.
I was going to say, do you like the sexy vampires? Or do you like the Nosferatu ugly, scary vampire?
I like the ugly, scary ones, but like Nosferatu, yeah, like that's my kind, but I appreciate the what you can do with the genre. So
very flexible. Good choice.
For me, since I am a lifelong sci-fi fan, I will say aliens are my favorite monsters.
I swear I thought you were going to say space vampires.
That would be a new answer.
That one 80s space vampire movie.
There's that one. I know the one you're talking about. And there was one on Buck Rogers in the 70s.
Ooh, that one.
Really?
Super creepy. It was very Nosferatu in space. It was very much so.
Yeah. Ooh, very cool.
Bizarre.
Yeah, no, I think I would go with aliens just because, yeah, I've always loved sci-fi, always been a big sci-fi fan.
Nice.
You could do so much with different kinds of aliens. It's like the sky's the limit.
Quite literally. What?
Quite literally. No pun intended. Totally unintentional.
Good solid answers. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about your book. This is really cool. I think listeners will really dig this. It's a surprising collection of creatures from a state that just doesn't seem like it's big enough to hold them all, but there it is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for having us. Yes, this was wonderful.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stoltzner.
You just heard an interview with Patrick Scalise and Valerie Ruby Oman, creators of the new book, Connecticut Cryptids, a field guide to the weird and wonderful creatures of the Nutmeg State. Links to their work will be in the show notes. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. We always say thanks for spending time with us, but that's only because we totally mean it. Thank you so much.
Been a Monster House presentation.